He's a psychologist, an author, and a veteran broadcaster. But most importantly, he's a dad. Welcome to Dr. Bill Meyer Live on the Faith Radio Network. Stay tuned for a faith and culture connection, a biblical perspective on current events, and practical family advice with psychologist Dr. Bill Meyer. You can join the conversation by calling 877-93-FAITH. That's 877-933-2484. Now, let's join Bill Meyer live.
Well, good morning. Don't you just love highs in the 20s and 30s? It's balmy. It's tropical compared to what it has been. As you're probably heard in your forecast there for the Twin Cities, we are looking for partly cloudy skies today, high about 28. Tomorrow, cloudy and 37. My gracious, it has just been a real tough road for a lot of folks in the upper Midwest over the last week or two, and we are so thankful that we're back to semi-normal, or I guess above normal for this time of year. So, well, welcome. It's so great to have you, and we have a fascinating hour lined up for you. You know, as Christians, we are called to live in the world but not be of the world. So how do we navigate popular culture, television, movies, all the mobile technology, music, video games, you name it? We're going to be talking to a fascinating gentleman who's written a great book on this topic called Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. And he'll be joining us from London, England in just a few minutes. I think you'll enjoy that. First, though, thought this might interest you, some research out on the impact of social media in our lives. And, well, it's not exactly good news. Researchers were looking at students, first of all. They looked at middle school, high school, and college students as they were studying. And they found that within 2 minutes, many of these kids were texting, tweeting, surfing the web, watching TV, or updating their Facebook page within 2 minutes. After 15 minutes, the researchers found that the students had spent just 65% of their time actually studying and, of course, distracted by all of those technology things that they were involved in. Meanwhile, let's not just talk about kids. Let's talk about adults for a second. New study out saying that 6 out of 10 employees visit social media sites such as Facebook or Twitter while they are on their boss's clock. Yeah, and maybe that's you. And if we do visit social media sites, on average, we are interrupted once every 10 minutes by tweets and Facebook messages and instant messages, status updates, the whole nine yards. After those interruptions, it takes us an average of 23 minutes to get back on task. So are you really giving your all at your workplace if you're doing that? By the way, I found a great article in Relevant Magazine. I don't know if you ever read Relevant, but it's a fascinating magazine. And they featured a very insightful article on social networking by Shauna Nyquist. This actually was one of their top 10 articles of 2013. And I just wanted to read a little bit of what Shauna says about social networking. She says, everybody's life looks better on the internet than it does in real life. The internet is partial truths. We get to decide what people see and what they don't. But community, the rich kind, the transforming kind, the valuable and difficult kind, doesn't happen in partial truths and well-edited photo collections on Instagram. Community happens when we hear each other's actual voices, when we enter into one another's actual homes with actual messes around actual tables, telling stories that ramble on beyond 140 pithy characters. Just a great essay on this topic, which I would highly recommend to you. If you go to Relevant Magazine's website, relevantmagazine.com, use their search engine, and you put in Instagram, Shauna's essay will come up, and very thought-provoking. I actually passed it along to a few friends this week, and we're all kind of on the same page with that. You know, you don't obviously technology is here to stay. It's necessary, and for many of us, it's indispensable when it comes to our work, but what is real community? What is real Christian community? It's not based on, you know, your Instagram page or communicating on Facebook with hundreds of friends. What does the Bible say? That Peter says, love one another deeply from the heart. And I personally don't believe it's possible to love hundreds of Facebook friends deeply. I don't know about you. Anyway, end of sermon. It's 9 minutes past 11. I'm Bill Meyer, and coming up next, we'll be chatting with Steve Turner from London about his brand new book, Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. Stick with us.
What is the real cost of divorce?
Dr. James Dobson for Family Talk.
I'm not talking about lawyer's fees or alimony or child support, and not just the cost to the individuals involved, the emotional scars that are left on adults and on children. Now researchers are finding out that high divorce rates carry major implications for the future of the nation. A recent study by the National Center for Health Statistics has found that school performance, physical and mental health in childhood, and dozens of behavioral problems are powerfully affected by a child's family life. For example, children whose parents are divorced are twice as likely to have to repeat a grade in school as children living with both their biological parents. The rate of measured behavioral and emotional problems is three times higher in children from single-parent homes. For instance, children from homes with a mother and a father present are far less likely to be suspended or expelled from school for disciplinary problems. Today, 40% of all children live with someone other than their biological parents, and that number is certain to grow. Every day, it becomes more and more clear. These times of quick and easy divorce are leading us down a path from which it will be difficult to recover. There has to be a better solution to conflict in marriage.
Contact Dr. Dobson at MyFamilyTalk.com.
It's Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio. Get ready to join the conversation. Now let's join Dr. Bill Meyer live.
And you can join the conversation by calling us at 877-93-FAITH, 877-93-FAITH. Write that number down, because if you call us this hour, give us your contact info, name, address, phone number, email, we'll put you into a drawing for a copy of one of Steve Turner's books, Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. We'll have that drawing at the end of the hour, but you got to call us here in the next 50 minutes or so and give us your contact info. Well, there is no avoiding popular culture. We have been enculturated into it. So the question is, what does it mean to be faithful Christians in a pop culture world? How do we think Christianly about celebrity and leisure? And joining us to talk about that is Steve Turner. He is a writer and poet living in London, where he regularly contributes to newspapers such as The Mail on Sunday and The Times. He has many books on cultural topics, including Conversations with Eric Clapton, U2, Rattle and Hum, Van Morrison, Too Late to Stop Now, and A Hard Day's Right, the stories behind every Beatles song. Today, Steve joins us to talk about his new book, Pop Cultured. And Steve, welcome to Faith Radio.
Hi.
It is such a blessing to have you.
Good morning, good afternoon. Pardon?
It's such a blessing to have you, and I know we have a little bit of a delay on the line because you're in London.
I am.
And it is a blessing to have you. It's, I'm guessing, about 5, 6 in the evening there right now?
That's right, yeah.
So I caught you at your dinner hour, and you were nice enough to give us some time. Thank you so much. Steve, before we talk about your book, let me ask you, I'm sure our listeners would love to get to know you personally. Can you tell us a bit about your personal background and your work as a journalist?
I was born and raised about 70 miles north of London, in the countryside, really, on the edge of a town. And I came to London in the early 1970s, and I've been living in London and writing ever since then. My work's a mixture of I write and perform poetry. I do travel journalism. I write books. I mean, I write books like Pop Cultured, which are kind of analyses of culture in some way. But I also have done a lot of, as you mentioned, some of the titles, biographies, particularly of musicians. And I also do interviews with with actors, with musicians for magazines and newspapers. I suppose that pretty much covers what I do.
Now, I mentioned several of the major music artists that you've written these biographies on. In those cases, were you able to actually interview these particular musicians, or did you just go out and research carefully their backgrounds?
I did a biography of Marvin Gaye, but I'd never met him. He was already dead by then. I did a biography of Johnny Cash. I had interviewed him, and I was going to collaborate on the book with him, but he died after signing the contract and before I could go out to Nashville and do the interviews. With you two, yes, I did interview them. Eric Clapton, I interviewed him. Van Morrison, I had already interviewed for another book, and I had a lot of excess material, and he didn't collaborate with me on the book, but I had met him. I think probably Marvin Gaye is the only person I've written about that I hadn't actually met.
Mm-hmm. What initially got you interested in the whole rock and roll scene?
I think it was just the age that I grew up in. I heard it on the radio. It seemed exciting music, and I was quite captivated by it. I mean, not just by the songs and the music, but also the style. You know, I thought these these singers really looked great, and I was just like so many of my generation, I was just kind of captivated by it. And then growing up in the 60s, the music seemed to sort of grow up with you. Like in the early 60s, it was all talking about, I want to hold your hand type of thing. And then in the mid-60s, it started to get more serious and tackle issues of religion and politics. And so I seem to be that generation that kind of grew up hand in hand with rock music.
It is interesting, you as you trace the history, and you do see the 1960s, so much of it love songs, and then moving into more cultural critique and politics and religion. Have we kind of come full circle when you look at today's pop music, as you survey the landscape? What is your impression of where pop music is today?
Well, it's just much harder to analyze and evaluate now because there seem to be so many types of music happening at the same time. I mean, you've got Miley Cyrus, and then you've got some rap singer sort of singing about life on the streets. Everything seems to be happening simultaneously, and also so many different generations are buying music now. I mean, people in their 70s or 80s will be buying music, as well as teenagers and people in their 20s. It's when I was growing up, if you looked at the pop charts, if you looked at the charts of the best-selling singles, you more or less could say that is what people between 12 and 20 are buying. Therefore, those songs possibly reflect what people in their teens are thinking. But you could no longer say that. I mean, you look at the charts, it represents what people from 10 to 90 are buying, I think.
And when you look at a particular age group or demographic, do you find that the music that they tend to gravitate towards, tend to hold most dear, is music that was playing on the radio when they were, let's say, in their teens or early 20s?
To an extent, I think that sort of gives you your grounding. I think that's always what you compare stuff to. But I think there are some people in my generation who feel the need to sort of keep up because that was an important part of growing up in the 60s. You wanted to be on top of things. And I can remember when I was a teenager, I think something that was a hit 6 months ago was like really old-fashioned, or something a year ago. that was like history. But there are still some adults, and I sometimes find myself not trusting them altogether, people that who might be 60 and hear a sort of a teenage group and go, wow, they're fantastic. I can't quite believe they're that enthusiastic. I think it makes more sense. I mean, it's just so much stuff that came out in the 60s and 70s that you never get around to hearing. There's so much stuff to keep you going without. I sometimes wish there was an amnesty on music and you could just catch up with what's already come out rather than having to go after new stuff.
What initially made you interested in the study between culture and religion, Steve?
I think it was because I grew up in a Christian home. As I've just said, I sort of had a conversion to rock and roll, if you like, at about, I suppose I must have been 8 or 9 or whatever. And then my own conversion to Christianity, late teens. And so I've always thought, how, you know, do you have to hold these things in attention, or is there a way of reconciling them? Or if Christianity is true, then it's got to have something to say about music. And if we're made in the image of God, then people's artistic creations have something to say as well. And I suppose, in a way, if I look back at the whole of my life, I've always been interested in that. You know, it is attention at times, and it's something that you never feel you've got absolutely right, and you kind of wrestle with it and struggle with it. So when I look back, the people that have interested me in rock and roll, people like Johnny Cash, Marvin Gaye, I mean, they seem very different people, Van Morrison, Eric Clapton, The Who, they've all... you know, they're all people that have sort of wrestled with these issues. They don't all come to the same conclusion that I've come to, but I'm more interested in kind of celebrating the search of these people. I think they've asked valid questions. They've pursued questions that I think are worth asking. I'm much more concerned when people don't ask the questions at all.
Now, as I you just said something a minute ago that I would love to expand on a bit. You talked about being made in the image of God, and therefore our creativity. God obviously is an incredible creative force. You look at how he has designed the universe and the stars above, and all the richness of the earth, and even human beings with all their complexity. How do you see us imaging God, the Imago Dei, in us when it comes to creativity, and how has the sin nature impacted that?
I think it's that it's that desire to want to make something. I can remember feeling it when I was very young. I wanted to make something out of nothing. I wanted to bring something into being that hadn't existed before. And I think that's part of that instinct. I mean, we're always Tolkien, the author of Lord of the Rings, among other things. He talked about us being sub-creators. I mean, God makes us. He's the ultimate creator, and we're kind of sub-creators. We're making because he's given us the mental equipment and also the materials to make. But, you know, nobody made God, so it is different in that respect. But I think acknowledging that all people, whether they defy God or worship God, still have that image. In fact, you know, the very skills that God gave them to worship him, they turn against him. But the actual skills, the mental ability, comes from God. But at the same time, we're fallen. You know, we're imperfect. So, you know, our creativity is imperfect. I know from writing poetry, you know, you don't always get it right first time. You write bad stuff. You write bad stuff when you think you're writing good stuff. So it affects us in that way. But it also affects our perceptions. You know, we get things wrong.
When I visit an art museum, Steve, and I recently took my kids to an art museum, and we looked at some of the classic art from the Middle Ages, the medieval days, and Renaissance, and then some more modern art. And what I seem to see, and you can correct me if you disagree with this, but as I looked at the classic art, what I saw was the artist, in a sense, putting on the canvas or in the sculpture a representation of what God had created, and there was a beauty to it that, whether it was in the lighting or the form or the color, that you found yourself relishing, this is something so beautiful, but it was really based on what God had wrought, what God had created. Then I looked at some of the modern art, and some of it was so troubling in that it seemed, not all of it, but much of it, seemed very dark and distorted and almost schizophrenic in a way. And again, I don't want to cast all modern art with a broad brush, because there's much modern art that's fascinating and beautiful. But what's going on there with how art has evolved and how the sin nature maybe has impacted, let's say, the visual arts?
I think people are less certain, and they're more likely even to not be able to trust their own perceptions. I think people like Picasso, I think he was very rightly saying, you know, we think we just look at someone's face and it's like as if you took a photograph, we just see it like that, but we actually don't, because we see it from multiple, you know, every second we're possibly looking at that face from a different angle because they're turning their heads. And he tried to grasp all of that, you know, all the many angles that we see a face at all at the same time. So a lot of his images seem very, very fractured because he's trying to capture that. I think one of the decisive things was the advent of photography, because that meant not only could we see human motion as it happens in sequences of photographs, it enabled people to study what was happening more closely, but also it kind of removed the need to have to paint a picture of someone, because you just took you could take a photograph now. So it kind of liberated artists to be able to do something else, and they began sort of playing with texture, playing with color, and doing something altogether different. But I think you're right that when people stop looking at the world as something made by God and ordered by God, and we're kind of living under God's sovereignty, I think you got a huge injection of despair and lostness into art. And I mean, I admire Francis Bacon as a painter, but his subject matter is quite, as you say, use the word troubling. I mean, it's very distorted. I mean, Bacon thought life was meaningless. He said it many times. But I think his portrayal of meaningless is actually quite accurate, you know. It's more accurate than somebody saying, rejecting God and painting beautiful pictures. Because I think if you honestly face up to what life would be like if you remove God, remove justice, remove guidance, remove the value of human beings, if you honestly faced up to that, then you would have a pretty ugly picture. And some artists like Samuel Beckett as a playwright, Francis Bacon as a painter, they have actually had the courage to face up to that conclusion.
How do you react as a journalist and even a critic to some of the art that actually attacks God or attacks Christianity? I'm thinking of Mapplethorpe and others, where it's so offensive. What's going on there, Steve?
Well, I suppose when people start arguing about it, it becomes an argument about the freedom of speech and the freedom to say that you don't believe in God or you disagree. Or I mean, some people actually want to cause offense, and very often they're people that have come from religious backgrounds when you look into it, and I think they feel more, I suppose they know what offends, and their minds are, they have all the kind of requisite images in their minds, and they know what to do with it, and they know what's powerful. If you truly didn't care about the church and truly didn't believe there was a God or Jesus was nothing of no account, then you possibly wouldn't be concerned to even mock him in that way. I think that's why John, you know, I wrote a book called The Gospel According to the Beatles, and I started that book with the story about how John Lennon made the statement that the Beatles had become more important than Jesus. And that caused a huge furore in America in 1966. But I think the reason that John would even introduce the figure of Jesus is because he possibly had the most churched background of all the Beatles. I mean, his aunt sent him off to the local church, and he went to Sunday school, and he sang in the choir. And I think you need that sort of background in order to be truly angry about God and start bringing his name up in that sort of way.
Mm. And you certainly see that with many of the modern, the neo-atheist authors, and you look into their backgrounds, and oftentimes there are some very understandable reasons why they are angry at God, and certainly in many cases angry at their human father. So,
well, yeah, I mean, Richard Dawkins went to Oundle School, which has got a pretty strong church foundation, and I think he had some relative, like a grandfather or something, that was a minister.
Mm-hmm. Steve, we've got a hard break coming up. I want to take a quick break. But we are talking to Steve Turner. He is the author of Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment, a fascinating new book on InterVarsity Press. We'll take a quick break and be right back with more.
Hi, this is Dick Whitworth, General Manager of Faith Radio. It's the start of a new year, and I hope one of the New Year's resolutions that you've made this year is to support Faith Radio. Your prayerful, generous support is changing lives across the Upper Midwest. You can give simply and safely online at myfaithradio.com or call 877-933-2484 to make your gift today.
Here's what's ahead on the next Connecting Faith.
The kingdom of God is dramatically advancing around the world. And we'll take time to hear the stories and review the challenges of living for Christ in closed countries on the next Connecting Faith. Miriam Adney is a professor of global and urban ministries at Seattle Pacific University and author of Kingdom Without Borders, The Untold Story of Global Christianity. We'll celebrate God at work in our world as we learn how to pray for fellow believers living out their faith in faraway places.
Listen for Connecting Faith, weekdays at noon on Faith Radio.
The conversation continues right now, and we want to hear from you. Call us at 877-933-2484. That's 877-933-2484. Now, here's Dr. Bill Meyer again on Faith Radio.
And thanks so much for joining us today. My guest is Steve Turner, the author of Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. Here's what Jeremy Begbie at Duke University says about this book. Steve Turner has proved himself one of the most accessible writers on the interaction of faith and culture. Pop Cultured is a welcome and lively exploration of what is fast becoming a crucial field. Some nice comments there from Jeremy, Steve.
Yes. I didn't pay him.
Now, you know, he mentions it is a crucial field, and there, I think Christians today tend to, unfortunately, land on one of two sides of this issue. Either they see all of pop culture as evil and of the devil and humanistic, and we've got to, you know, go live in a log cabin in Montana and unplug everything. And then there are those who may wholeheartedly embrace pop culture, but do it in an uncritical way where they're actually embracing things that are, frankly, very contrary to what God would tell us in his word. So how do we navigate that tension?
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right. I suppose I grew up, I mean, my early years were more in the era where people did have blanket condemnations of certain things, you know, like the television was absolutely wrong, you wouldn't have one, or you would never dare to enter a cinema, or rock and roll was of the devil. And there's quite a history of people picking on, you know, like theater in the 17th century, and there was a time when people thought the fiddle was the devil's instrument. So you've had those... You've had those eras when there was, as I say, sort of a blanket condemnation. Then you've obviously had people that have gone into communities that have sort of cut themselves off from the world from whatever point the community was founded and feel that that's the right way to live. But then, you know, what I come across more often these days is people that in saying that the earlier approach was wrong, they've gone to the other extreme and they kind of watch everything, listen to everything, and are really kind of indiscriminate in the sense that they just come to the same conclusions as all their contemporaries, because you kind of tend to get pushed in a certain direction. You know, you're told that this TV series is great, and then you just say, yeah, it was great, without just sort of analyzing the detail. I suppose the solution is really that, I mean, in all aspects of our life, whether it's marriage, education, work, whatever aspect of life, it should be you know, governed by what God says, and we find that in the scriptures. The difficulty always is, you know, how do you apply certain parts of scripture? Because the people that say it's all wrong and the people that say it's all right have probably got their scriptures to back up their position. But I think there's that. Then I think there's a lot of material around now. You know, people are writing far more about these subjects, and there's plenty of guidance, and there are websites that could help, you know, people reviewing films and things like that. I think it's good if people could go in groups and see, you know, listen to music or see theatre or go to an art gallery or whatever. If you could debate it afterwards, discuss it, that can be really helpful. But I suppose ultimately it's reading scripture and letting it really kind of sink into your heart so that, you're not having to constantly dash to a reference book to find out whether something's good or honorable. You actually instinctively begin to learn what's good and what's bad.
Do you believe that we should be cautious when it comes to what we consume? In that, I talk to a lot of Christians. Let me give you an example. This is from a few years ago, and I'd just love to get your opinion on this. I was involved in a large church Sunday school class, and it was a mixture of singles and marrieds. I think the age range was probably mid-20s to early 40s, so about half single, about half married. And a large number of the – this was back in the days when Sex and the City was a very popular television program. And a large number of the women in this particular group would watch the show every week and then kind of dialogue about it, compare notes. And they just thought this was the most wonderful thing. And my wife and I were a bit troubled in that we felt okay, the Bible talks about very clearly about, fleeing from immorality and as you just quoted that part of that scripture, whatever is noble and pure, and yet here they were, these Christian women, relishing a program that, now, obviously was well-written, well-acted, had interesting storylines, but the premise of the show itself was something that was really far afield from what a Christian woman should be dwelling on. And I don't know. We didn't criticize them. We kind of, between my wife and I, between the two of us, were saying, does this make sense? How would you analyze something like that? Because obviously that's just one isolated incident, but I think it represents a lot of Christians today who are consuming culture uncritically.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was one of the programs in my mind, because I've seen, I've been around Christians that have watched it, and they just they say it's good because they identify with the characters, and they say, well, these people are really good. They support each other. They share with each other, and it's about friendship. And then they say, I'm not going to act like these people. I'm not going to copy them. I'm not going to imitate their lives. But I think there are shows that come along that kind of, they put forward a lifestyle that's sort of more unchristian than the last big TV series. And, even Sex and the City is considered a bit tame now, but
right.
It was presumed to be shocking at the time. Yeah, and I think the whole presupposition of it, that these girls are liberated because they're just having sort of multiple sexual relationships with all sorts of different people is far away from the Christian position. Yet the more you see programs like that, the more likely you are to think this is perfectly normal. I mean, I've talked to people in the industry, and they make the point that this was, that the series was the idea of a gay guy in New York, and also I think it's involved several gay writers, and this person said to me, it's really for gay guys in New York, that's what it really is, but they made them women. But there is, if you think about it in that way, you can see that their lifestyle is more like that than it was for sort of young women at the time. But they sometimes when you read interviews with the people that make these programs, they're quite proud that they're changing people's perceptions, and we'd be really stupid not to realize that we are being subject to quite clever, educated people who want to change the world in some way. They think there's they want to see things progressed in some way as far as they're concerned, and so they feel that TV series like this help to progress things. I mean, my son often watches that, Two and a Half Men, which is the same sort of thing, really. I mean, it's really quick-witted, and the lines are delivered so well. But again, the premise behind it is not a good one.
Hmm. Do you think that, and I know you're not a pastor, Steve, but obviously you're thinking about this, you're engaging with this issue on a daily basis. Do you think that our churches should be more forthright in giving guidance to Christians, to congregations, on the how we consume culture? I mean, some might say, oh, it's not a pastor's role, or that's just legalistic, or blah, blah, blah. But I wonder sometimes if it seems that there is the voice is absent there from many in the pulpit because, well, we just want to accept everyone, and we have very grace-based churches, which I think is wonderful. I think certainly the gospel is all about grace. However, if we're ignoring the fact that a large portion of our congregations are just seeped in this stuff, and we're not just talking about TV and, you know, certainly many cable movies and music, video games, we can go on and on. We're often, I think Barna's research would bear this out, we often pretty much look like the world in the media we consume. So is there room for a prophetic voice there in our churches?
I think it would be better to teach people how to evaluate these things than to set up lists like the Catholic Church used to do in the 30s and 40s, where they would have like a list of films you can watch and a list of films you can't watch. I think it would be better if you gave people the equipment to deal with the films and maybe information. If you know when you come across interviews with people and directors, for example, and they're saying this is my intention, this is what I want to do, I think if the Christian public was more aware of that, and we shouldn't always think that it's all going to be negative, because there's so much popular culture that's enhancing and enriching, and we want to hear from those people too, you know, why they're doing what they're doing, and we want to support people that are doing things that we think bring dignity to people and are evaluating the world in a way that's consistent with the way the Bible evaluates the world.
And we should point out, and I'm sure you make this point in the book, that doesn't necessarily need to be a Christian author or filmmaker. It could be someone who does not have a Christian worldview, but because it rains on the just and the unjust, and that person has been able to decipher from God's created order the good in human beings, and maybe the tension between being created in God's image and being fallen. And so even if they're not writing or producing from a distinctly Christian viewpoint, much of what they're saying could be very redeeming, very, very redemptive.
Yeah, I think it's truth that should be the what we're judging it by, not necessarily the whole gospel. You know, you wouldn't expect somebody who's not a believer to be articulating the gospel, but they can articulate truth in what they've seen and what they've found. And sometimes they're more courageous in their explorations than Christians who feel maybe a little bit bound by dogma or bound by their particular church. I was most helped by Hans Ruttmacher, who was an art historian and also a Christian believer from Holland. And he said, when you're evaluating art, you have to ask, I think he said three or four questions, and one of them was, is it good? You know, is it technically good? And another one was, is it true? And another one was, does it have integrity? Because I used to get confused, because you'd hear a Christian group singing a really bad, poorly produced, unimaginative song that happened to have words of truth in it, and you think, well, I guess I'm expected to put a tick by that and say it's good. And then you have the Rolling Stones singing a song, and you thought, no, I'm supposed to say that's bad because they're not Christians. But if you had those categories, you could say, you know, when the Stones sing Satisfaction, you could say, well, is it good? Well, yeah, it's a great production. It's a great riff. Does it have integrity? Well, I think it's true to the experience of Mick Jagger, you know, touring around America in 1965 and feeling pestered by radio advertising and feeling that he could get no peace and no satisfaction. Is it true? Well, ultimately not true, because you can get satisfaction. But, you know, there are those questions to ask, and then you might have some Christian groups singing something. You say, well, it's true, but it's terribly produced. It's got no imagination. It's boring.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it wonderful
think,
when...
You know, Christians have sometimes thought you've got to vote good or bad according only to one criteria, and that is like, does it reflect the gospel in some way?
Mm-hmm. I'm loving the fact that we're starting to see some very well-made Christian films that are well-written, well-acted, and have a redeeming message and aren't unidimensional.
Right. I don't know if I've seen them, but I'm happy for you.
There's a few. I think what we're starting to see is more and more young Christian filmmakers who are, you know, willing to take this on. And, yeah, they're not going to get bankrolled by the major studios, certainly. But
the thing is with films, you can't – I mean, the trouble with Christians is they tend to want to take on everything and do the whole gospel, you know, in one film. And you can't really do it. And when I look at the Bible, I mean if you read, you know, Ecclesiastes or Proverbs or Psalms, one psalm one proverb may only make one point. It may say, surround yourself with good people. Don't mix with bad people. They're going to corrupt you. And in a sense, that would be enough for a film just to make that one point. Mm. And you look through those books in the middle of the Bible and you find they just make point after point after point of things which are just, you might say they're good common sense, but they're redemptive because they're good common sense. And, you know, it's very hard to, if you're trying to push everything into one film. And the other thing, if you try to push everything into one film, is you tend to sacrifice the story because you're just wanting to make points. And a film is not a sermon. I mean, a sermon, yeah, you might expect to lead that sermon and say, well, he's, you know, the preacher said A, B, and C, and this was the conclusion. But you can't always expect, well, you shouldn't really expect it of art at all, because art communicates to us in a different way. It may be the songs I love from 30, 40 years ago, and I still haven't really listened to the lyrics. I still haven't wondered what the song's about. Because part of the power of a song is just the sound of the language, just the lovely, the way the music and the words just, I mean, because Phil Everly died recently, I've been listening to Everly Brothers songs, and there's just something about the language they use, and it's just so sweet, and their voices are so sweet. And those songs, which I love, I've never actually typed them up and said, what are they about? Because that songs communicate on a different level.
I recall several years ago, I think it was Dan Peek of the group America, and you know, they had those very poetic songs, A Horse with No Name, Sister Golden Hair, and I think it was Dan that was asked in an interview, you know, well, what does Horse with No Name really mean? Is there some kind of a drug message behind it, or is it psychedelic? And I think his response was something along the lines of, no, they were just words that sounded good together.
Yeah.
It was just poetry. It was just unique, beautiful imagery, but it didn't really have a hidden meaning to it. And sometimes that's what art is about, right? Just beauty.
Musicians often will start with a song and they will have what they consider to be a dummy lyric. They know it's got to sound something like this. Because the music suggests the words, and the words suggest the music. But then they will go back and kind of patch it up and put some new words in. Or sometimes they don't. Sometimes they leave the original words. And that happened with a lot of the Beatles songs. I mean, Hey Jude's got a lot of fairly nonsensical sentences in there that were, like, the movement you have is on your shoulder. And people say, oh, yeah, that's it. But it was just, it just sounded right.
That's true. I remember.
The movement you need is on your shoulder. That's it. Sorry.
Well, when I remember first hearing the song and trying to analyze it, and yeah, maybe it can't be. We're talking to Steve Turner. He is the author of Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. It's a new book from InterVarsity Press. We highly recommend it to you. We're going to take a quick break and come back with one final segment with Steve here on the Faith Radio Network. Stick with us.
Faith Radio's mission is to lead people to Christ and nurture you in your spiritual growth through Christ-centered media. We recently connected online with David from Bangladesh.
I'm so glad to have been introduced to MyFaithRadio.com. I like to listen to Faith Radio, which I get through this address online. It's my wish that God will expand His ministry everywhere in the world.
MyFaithRadio.com crosses borders and even oceans. Log on today at MyFaithRadio.com and join the conversation helping to spread the message of Faith Radio.
On the next Everyday Relationships.
Dating, divorce, family drama. Well, needless to say, relationships can get complicated. And that's why we do this show, to help you love God and to love others in a way that helps you sort through these issues. So, what's going on in your life? Let's talk about it live at 855-2-RELATE.
Everyday Relationships. Real life, real talk. Weekdays at 4 on Faith Radio.
It's hard not to get excited.
When you discover the quality of academics at Northwestern and the joy and Christ-like attitude of the students, well, it's hard not to want to experience it. Saturday, January 25th, you can experience Northwestern life at Hoops Hysteria. Tour the campus, chat with students, and cheer on the Eagles basketball teams. And someone might win a semester's worth of free tuition and books at halftime. To sign up, visit unwsp.edu/visit. University of Northwestern, St. Paul. Your life on purpose.
Now, back to Dr. Bill Meyer live on Faith Radio.
And welcome back. Our guest is Steve Turner. He's the author of Pop Culture, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment. Steve is a writer and a poet living in London. He regularly contributes to newspapers such as The Mail on Sunday and The Times, and has written numerous books, including Conversations with Eric Clapton, U2, Rattle and Hum, Van Morrison, Too Late to Stop Now, and A Hard Day's Right, the stories behind every Beatles song. Steve, you write in your book that the word culture means to play a part in cultivating people. Can you expand on that a bit for us?
Yeah, just if you look at the etymology of the word, the origin of the word, it shares roots with cultivation. And has something to do with cultivation. I mean, we think of culture. Well, people in the 19th century used to talk a lot about art and culture as something that would make people better. It was a kind of something that would morally improve people. And I think you can see that in museums and galleries that we have in London. They were built almost like temples or cathedrals. And people still walk around art galleries with a great sense of hushed reverence for the work on the walls, and I think people still have this idea that art somehow, even though it may be baffling to them, they think it's going to do them good. They'll sit through a Shakespeare play even though they find it pretty difficult, because they think it's going to better them in some way. So I suppose when you think of cultivation, you think of pulling weeds out, you think of breaking up soil, you think of irrigation, just making the soil fertile enough to bring forth fruit. And I think culture can do those sort of things for us. It shouldn't be a replacement for the gospel, which it was for a lot of people. I think as the gospel was sidelined, particularly in Europe, then art filled the space. And I think if you talk to a lot of people who say, I'm spiritual but I'm not religious, they would put art in a very important place in their lives, because that's when they feel most, in inverted commas, spiritual. Have I answered the question?
Yeah, no, it's well said. And maybe you can develop that a bit more too. People that use culture to replace God. Obviously, as we discussed earlier, well done art in many ways teaches us about God or His created order. How He has designed us to best function, how relationships work and don't, the cause and effect relationships maybe that we see in Proverbs. We can find that often in a good film or a good book or good song. But is there a danger even for Christians with idolizing culture, idolizing art or cinema?
There's always a danger. I mean, it talks in the Bible, I think it's Paul in Romans, he talks about people worshipping the creation rather than the creator. I think that can happen. And I think artists very often, actors, songwriters, musicians, novelists, they're kind of put in a position in society where we think they've got more to say about things than other sorts of people, and almost have come to occupy the place that maybe pastors, ministers, bishops or whatever had in the past. We think they're the people with the most insight. I mean, I often see it in newspapers in my country, when there's a big issue, they'll get a bunch of people to discuss it and more than likely there'll be a good sprinkling of artists there, and I think artists have got better perceptions. Maybe they do to some extent, because if you're an artist, if you're a writer, you do spend a lot of time pondering. I mean, that's part of your job, and you do analyze yourself and you do analyze the world into which you've been put. So there is something to be said for that. But I think there's a word of caution could be said about Christians seeing the artist taking that place, thinking, well, if we got involved in art, then we could take advantage of that, instead of seeing that art shouldn't be in that place anyway.
Are you troubled? We've just got about a minute and a half left, Steve. Are you troubled when you hear Christians saying we need to take back the culture?
Yeah, no, I mean, when I hear people say, you know, we're going to take Hollywood, when they don't even like films in the first place, I think you really, whatever art form you work in, you should really love the art form itself and ask this question of yourself. You know, are you going to make film better because you were there? Are you going to make fiction better because you were there? Are you going to make poetry better because you were there? These things are not there just for us to sort of take over and stick our message in and then retreat. They're there. One of the services that poetry performs is it refines language, and that's a great job in and of itself. And we should think about making the art forms better than they were when we embarked on them.
Well, Steve, as we wrap up here, any challenge to Christians as they engage with the culture moving forward?
Yeah, I think it's always. It is always challenging. If you don't find it challenging, you're probably not doing it right. I think we need to learn to enjoy it as well. I should say that if it's always just a challenge and a problem and how do you deal with it, then you're missing the very reason that God made us creators and culture makers, which is to enhance and enrich our lives.
Mm, beautifully said.
A life without music, without song. Imagine it, you know, without stories. It would be, there's lovely images in the Bible of desolate cities, and it's always the music has stopped, you know. And that's a bad sign when the music stops.
Hmm. I'm even thinking of C.S. Lewis's Narnia with the White Witch, and it's always winter but never Christmas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Steve, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a wonderful discussion. I want to again, commend this book to our listeners. It's called Pop Cultured, Thinking Christianly About Style, Media, and Entertainment by Steve Turner. Steve, may the Lord bless you and your work, and thank you for this labor of love.
Thank you very much.
This is the Faith Radio Network. Steve from London today, and we appreciate you wherever you are in the upper Midwest listening to Faith Radio. We'd encourage you to stick around. We have more great programs, and you can find out all about our schedule, both the weekday schedule and the weekend schedule, by going to myfaithradio.com. I will be back next Saturday at 11 a.m. Until then, have a wonderful weekend. Stay warm.